Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
About a month ago, we talked with Tony Carnes, a journalist who is currently in the midst of one of the most interesting research projects related to religion that you can find on the World Wide Web. That project is called A Journey Through New York City Religions, and he is literally, and I mean literally, walking and mapping the spiritual core of the Big Apple, traversing some 6,000 odd miles of roads to do it. That previous interview largely focused on how Tony got to the point of doing that project, surveying his globe-trotting life starting in Texas and ending up currently in New York. We also talked about some of the organizational details of the Journey Project, its funding, and we finished off with some general thoughts on the spiritual life of the city that never sleeps. Contrary to the image that it is also the city that never prays, Mr. Carnes informed us that that is quite the opposite. New York is alive with a religiosity that is continually changing and being renewed by the influx of immigrants. The one thing that we did not do in great detail, and this is to the chagrin of a couple of our listeners, is to review what Tony's journey had uncovered to date. As mentioned, his website, which we will link to on our website, is a multimedia extravaganza of fascinating and often inspiring stories. So today, we will dispense with the organizational details of this project and just dive into the findings. For those of you who did not hear the first interview, this interview should stand alone, but feel free to peruse the earlier episode and the other 152 shows in our archive. Finally, I will let you know that Tony is an award-winning journalist who serves as a senior staff writer for Christianity Today and is the co-editor of several books including New York Glory, Religions in the City with Anna Karpathakis, and Asian American Religions, The Making and Remaking of Borders and Boundaries with Fengang Yang. As always, those links can be found on our website, and we will also mention them on our Facebook fan page. And come on, folks, we are 20 likes away from 400 fans. Help us achieve that number by the end of June. East Coast Tony, welcome back to Research on Religion.
It's good to be back to talk to West Coast Tony and about the world of faith in New York and a great project you have.
Yeah, it's a great project that you have, too. And I should note that you're not the only repeat guest that we have, but you are the quickest returning guest. And that's because in addition to some feedback I received from listeners who wanted to hear more about the details of New York City religion, during the interview, I realized that we didn't have nearly enough time to survey everything that you've done with this project, which is still ongoing. So let's get down to brass tacks and start talking about what religion in Gotham is really like. You ready?
Yeah.
All right. Hey, let's start with the first month or so of your project, which appeared on the web in July of 2010. But as I understand it from our last podcast, you'd been doing some footwork prior to that. Now, here's my first question. Where did you start your investigative journey? And did you target some specific locales first? Did you have something in mind? And what'd you find there?
Well, we started in a couple of places. We started in the Lower East Side. We started in the South Bronx, and we started in Staten Island. Sequentially, the South Bronx was important because we looked at three community districts, and we started in early 2010. Actually, in 2009, we were already doing some work because we needed to do some work before we launched in July 2010. In the South Bronx, we did a census of religious sites and then compared them to various lists we had collected, nonprofit lists, state tax lists, phone records, and so forth. And what we discovered is that our list, which for those three community districts in the South Bronx, and they were the poorest, among the poorest community districts in all of the United States, didn't our list, which we thought was pretty good, turned out not to be so good. We missed about somewhere between 30% and 40% of the religious sites, and that's because the vagaries of how particularly poor congregations list themselves. So often the post office box or the phone that is for the church or other type of religious site is in out of the house of where the person lives, and it may not even be in the community district. In fact, often isn't.
Mm.
And so you don't really get a geographic patterning that way. Another thing is we looked at other national censuses of religion, and as you know, the various national censuses of religion leave out cannot cover certain aspects. They don't cover African American denominations very well, or Hispanic or Chinese. And we discover, of course, that means you're talking about a pretty large portion of New York City.
Right.
It's not listed in any of the religious censuses. So we knew that we had to do something. And then we started out down in the Lower East Side, the Chinatown, Little Italy area, and we quickly ran across that we needed to be much more story intensive, and we needed to develop ways to really get into the stories of the sites there and develop ways to create narratives from the sites we're visiting.
Was there a particular finding or a particular group you stumbled on where you said, wow, these folks got a really interesting story, we need to tell this more and just then clicking some numbers on our computer to put it into a census?
Well, we ran across the most strange church in the Lower East Side. A strange, don't even in a sense that it was so unfamiliar. There was a Spanish-speaking church that was the pastor there came out of the Russian, that used to be a Russian Orthodox church, and the pastor there came out of Russian Orthodoxy and moved into sort of Western Orthodox / Catholic tradition. And they started a Spanish-speaking church with a very Orthodox rite.
Hmm.
And I thought, what is this? And furthermore, the pastor had completely ornamented the inside of the church with decorations and paintings, and incredibly beautiful church. And I would say that almost nobody knows about this church, this little jewel, a Spanish-speaking Orthodox church down on the Lower East Side. In fact, it's a very particular type of church. It uses the Mozabaric rite, which is a Catholic rite that predates the Latin rite. I mean, it predates 6th century. In fact, when the Visigoths came into invasion in southern Europe, they picked up the Mozabaric rite. Well, we have a Mozabaric rite, Spanish-speaking, Orthodox-leaning church on the Lower East Side. That blows my mind.
I think that kind of speaks to a lot of the you know, immigrant blending that we had been talking about in the last interview, where you have influx of immigrants and they just mix and you know, relate to one another and change things a lot.
Yes, you've got you run across these incredible mixes. Just the other day, I ran across a two teachers of the Bronx. They are very religious. One is an Afghan Hispanic Muslim, and the other one is a Chinese American Jew. Now, Judaic belief. Now, those two are partners in teaching kids who are African and from various South American and Caribbean countries. Now, there is the picture. Now, so we started on the Lower East Side. We discovered we need to have more narrative to tell these stories. We also need to treat our data different. We learned that before we were sort of collecting data, and then we would illustrate our stories. And we really realized that we needed to be very data-driven. That is, the data itself need to push us to write stories. Now, this was a discovery, what we has been called by The Guardian, which in the United Kingdom, which pioneered something called data-driven journalism. They were discovering this idea just about the time, actually exactly the same time, that we were saying, you know what, in the past, statistics were gathered to illustrate stories, but they were not gathered systematically to create and drive the stories in the news media. Sounds very subtle, but the difference is that the data actually becomes more your editor than the editor saying, oh, get the story on population changes of New York, and you go and get the data, and you use that to illustrate your story. Now you're using data to sort of drive those stories in a much more thoroughgoing way, and we discovered we really need to do that in the Lower East Side. We discovered there are many things that we didn't know just by counting. We discovered there were African-American storefronts on the Lower East Side. And everybody thinks of Jews and Italians and other immigrants coming into the Lower East Side, but they forget that the Lower East Side was also a big center of African-American life in the city. And there's still African-American storefront churches there. And I got to tell you, I didn't really realize they were there until we started counting.
Yeah, one of the things you mentioned earlier is that our typical census of churches that we do often underreport African-American, Asian-American churches. Why do you think that is? Is it because they're crammed away in these little storefronts, these little nooks and crannies and back alleyways and things?
Well, there are two reasons. One, most of the census that we often use are self-reported. That is, cooperating denominations agree to turn over their data to the organizer of the religious census. And that's very useful for, and they do that here in New York, like the Assembly of God provide their material to efforts like this. And you can trace the changes in the number of people and members and church attenders and in that cooperating groups, but most African-American church denominations are not cooperating with those projects. Hispanic, Spanish-speaking, Korean-speaking, Chinese-speaking, other type-speaking, other language-speaking churches don't very often don't cooperate with those.
Why do you think that is? I mean, I can maybe understand a recent immigrant church. They get something in the mail saying, hi, we're taking a census, please report stuff. And you look at it, it's a foreign language, and you just toss in the wastebasket. But with African-American churches, I mean, a lot of them speak English.
Well, I think you'd have to ask the people that collect that data why they weren't able to get the collection. You also do get a lot of change in New York and in other places. You get a lot of new groups grow up, and they're not, and new religions arise, and they're not captured very readily. And you also get small places, but they're not all small. For example, one of the large databases for religion in the city don't actually have the largest church in New York City, which is Christian Cultural Center. At least they didn't that last time I checked, and that's because that's an African-American church, and it's an independent African-American megachurch. So the count of independent churches is very low in those type of databases, and in fact, it doesn't count the largest one in New York City, which is 31,000 people.
Wow.
Members. So
let me just quick drop you back to that other church. I just had a question I forgot to ask. The Spanish-speaking Russian Orthodox Church, how big was that?
It was a very small church.
Okay.
And it's no longer Russian Orthodox. They changed over to this a Catholic rite that's very similar to Orthodox.
Okay.
But it's a very small church. But they do have members. They do have Spanish members coming from the housing projects just down the street from them. So it's in New York terms, or in numbers terms, it's a small church.
Okay, probably what, a couple dozen people attending, maybe 100?
That's right.
Okay. Now, I have a number of stories that I looked at your website and I'm fascinated to get to, but I want to allow you to tell some of the things that stand out most in your mind. You've been doing this, you know, for 2.5, coming close to 3 years of really working specifically with this project. And there's certain stories that just must pop out in your mind. What was the most interesting thing you found in your journey to date?
That's all very hard. We've visited over just about 6,500 religious sites in the city. A lot of interesting things. But I think maybe that's the most interesting thing, is the sheer magnitude of faith in the city. We would estimate there's around 11,000 to 12,000 religious sites in New York City. The sheer magnitude is staggering. And even though we started with knowing that the magnitude probably was large, we had no estimate of that, and other previous estimates were much lower. One estimate gave, in Queens, that there was almost no growth of Taoist and Buddhist groups in Queens, and there was only like one or two in their estimates. And yet, in fact, we visited 16 Taoist places.
Wow.
In Queens. So that's a 16-to-1 era, and mm-hmm. we didn't have any idea about that. And it continually surprises me about the magnitude of religious change in New York. We counted very well in Elmhurst, Queens, which is, according to U.S. Census, the most ethnically diverse area of the entire world. Over 160 nationality groups are in that community district. And we've counted and we've traveled the streets very often because it is such a world center, a crossroads. And I was walking down the street the other day and one of the main streets, which is Broadway in Elmhurst, and I look up above and there is, in Chinese, is a sign, Buddhist Monastery.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking, we don't have that.
Yeah.
We had no idea that existed. And it just come up there. So the sheer magnitude. Surprising things also come up. That is, maybe the most interesting thing is magnitude, but there are surprises around every corner. That is one. Maybe the biggest surprise that we had is that 1978 was a pivotal year for faith in New York City. We ask each of these places we go, when were you founded? And then we chart, the rate of founding. And this is rate of net founding, because obviously quite a few have disappeared or moved or so forth. So this is the net rate of founding, the ones that succeeded and are still here. And we noticed that from 1950 to 1978, the rate of founding was less than replacement value. It's very low. 0.5% of new places in the year, religious places, were founded. What we noticed in 1978, that popped up quite a bit. It tripled almost, doubled or tripled, the rate of founding of, for example, of Protestant churches. That's a triple, and that's still very small. It was like 1.5, 1.3% of new places founded every year. It's actually a pretty high rate and would create significant church growth because it becomes geometric if you maintain those percent as you compound the interest, so to speak. But then we discovered that so that 1978 becomes a pivotal year, and it, now a lot of things start to make sense about why New York changed. In 1970s, you have some pivotal elections in New York City. In 1970s, early 80s, Rudolph Giuliani first lost running for mayor. He got beat by David Dinkins, who's from Harlem. But I got a call when Giuliani decided to run against Dinkins, and we're not very partisan, but the Dinkins campaign called me and said, we need some help. And I said, well, I don't do political campaign advising, and I'll just tell you what I know about the faith situation. He says, well, that's all we need to know. And so I go down to City Hall during just a couple weeks before the election. So I thought this is pretty late. And they said, you know what? We don't know what churches are going to do in Harlem in the vote. And I'm thinking, this is the Harlem political machine. And they don't know the churches. Well, what happens is they were relying on a lady who said, I can get the 440 churches, she said, to come out and vote. But she actually only knew the older churches. And most of the membership in the older churches actually live in the suburbs and so are not eligible to vote in New York. The new churches, the ones that were growing, were the independent Pentecostal churches in Harlem. And they didn't know them. They said, so can you tell us who we should talk to? And I said, well, and I thought in the back of my mind, if the Harlem political machine doesn't even know its own power base, then they are doomed. But I said, look, I'll tell you exactly what we would tell anybody if Giuliani asked us, we'd tell it. These are the most important leaders there. But it was way too late. Now, what happened is, and subsequent election analysis bears it out, David Dinkins was elected as African. He was the first African American mayor, and he was immensely popular among African Americans because he was a very big breakthrough for New York. However, his handling of racial tension alienated a lot of the Pentecostal and evangelical black churches in the city because he allowed those relations, particularly with the Jewish population, to escalate and become very negative. Now, Giuliani won not because he won the black vote. He didn't win the black vote. But several percent, the black vote dropped in the second election for Dinkins. Dropped enough to make the difference and make Giuliani the winner. Now, that's because they said, well, we don't like this exacerbation of racial tensions that Dinkins is using to try to drive his campaign. So they just sat on their hands. They didn't vote for Giuliani. They didn't particularly like Giuliani. But they didn't vote against him. They just didn't tell their people to go out and vote for Dinkins. And the depression of the black vote cost Dinkins the re-election. Now, what did that mean for New York? Many people often say, well, Rudolph Giuliani, was Edward Koch and Rudolph Giuliani and Michael Bloomberg have really changed New York, and New York has really, really changed. They brought in a theory, Giuliani brought in a theory called the broken windows theory. That is, if you deal with small disorders in the city, you actually have an impact on the big disorders, like crime. Small disorders meaning things like, trash on the street, window washers that harass people, panhandlers, prostitutes, things that are street, very visible on the street, create a sense of disorder and disorder of the city. Well, what Giuliani brought and what the new religious change brought in the city was that we need to move from social responsibility, that is, people are not responsible for their actions because society causes them, to the idea of individual responsibility, that people need to be responsible and we need to have a moral order that supports individual responsibility. We need to help people on the street level to know their city will deal with disorder, moral disorder. And I believe you can actually root, and I have only this sort of plausible analysis. I wouldn't call it proof, a very strong proof, that the religious change that started happening in the mid-70s translated into a desire for churches to and other religious groups to create more moral order, and they supported Giuliani, even if they did that support by not voting in the election, and that made possible the revival of New York City. In other words, the revival of New York City is a faith-based story, not just a political or economic story. And I think that's what is most surprising to me, that as we, I did have some wonder if that wasn't going on, but then when we compile our statistics, we found that 1978 was like the annus mirabile, you know, the miracle year, the year that all of a sudden faith groups started founding, accelerated their founding of new religious sites. Now, along the way, that was really the most surprising thing. And the story is, the headline is, you want to know why New York has been so successful in the last decade. It's a faith-based story.
Yeah. Well, we're going to cover some of the reasons for that, as well as these faith-based entrepreneurs that we talk about. I do have some specific questions about stories that you have up on your website, some of them which are very, very inspiring. But also just, you know, reflecting on your past 3 or 4 years doing this, have there been any, you know, very unusual moments where you ran across something that just, you know, the strangest church or strangest group of individuals or something like that?
Well, yes, and sometimes we ran across very early on. We ran across a guy who practiced in Chinatown, who practiced hammering on people's bodies in order to relieve aches and pains.
Ouch!
Now, this particular practice goes back to Taoist belief that there's certain forces. And you can counteract bruises and aches and pains by sort of creating a symbolic bruise or ache of pain in another part of the body. Now, some people see that as sort of like a technology, not a religion. Other people see it as a technology that came out of a religious belief. So it sort of depends on how you define Taoism and Taoist scientific notions. But that was sort of interesting. That was unusual. Another one that was surprising and funny and at the same time is we stopped at a place in the Bronx called Jesus's Auto Body Shop. And it could be Jesus, right?
Right.
Hispanic, a name, very common. And I said, no, we got to stop this. And it was late in the evening. It was a very dangerous area of the Bronx. And I said, we've got to go and stop here. This is our last street in the community district that we were in. And it was basically a long alleyway that dark. And my reporters that were with me were very dubious about stopping. So I said, okay, y'all guys stay in the car, and I'll go out. So I went out and started photographing, and the group of guys come swarming out of the auto body shop. And they look pretty tough. They look pretty hardened. And I looked back at the car, and my guys were sunk down in the seats to start looking out over them. I said, oh, great. And I had this great big expensive camera, and they said, what are you doing taking pictures for? And I said, well, the best way to handle a dicey situation is just to, you know, go forward. And I explained what we're doing. We're mapping faith in the city. I wonder if Jesus' Auto Body Shop is. And the guy said, you know what? We're just having a Bible study. You want to come join? See what we're doing?
Wow.
He said, he said, my life was totally turned around. I was a heroin. I was arrested with a suitcase of heroin. And I was holding it for another friend, and I didn't even know I was holding heroin. He had deposited, but I got arrested and sent to prison, and I was praying. I was just really bitter against the world, and the chaplain came to me, and I became converted in prison, and I told the chaplain my story that I actually, even though I was, you know, involved in different things, I didn't know about this because my friend just dropped some stuff off and said, can you hold it for me? Said, I didn't know what that was. And in fact, I asked him, and he just said, oh, it's just suitcase clothes and stuff. So I kept it. Well, and the chaplain says, you know what? You ought to file a petition, and we'll pray about it. So he filed a petition. He got out of prison. It was a 20-year sentence. He got out. They said, okay, we vacate. He said, you know what? And then he got out of prison and he became homeless because he didn't have a job and people were afraid of him. So he prayed one time while he was in a vacant lot. He says, God, if you will help me, I'll dedicate my life to you. And it happened that a friend of his says, you know, I have an empty garage. Would you like to start an auto body shop there and you can bunk there while you're getting started? So he called his, he said, ah, God has answered my prayer. He created Jesus' auto body shop. He's a lot of his old Confederates he's brought into a Bible study and works in a garage. And they, in order to keep their life straight and all the temptations and pressures, he holds a Bible study on Friday nights. So there on Friday nights, these are scary-looking guys from prison, very hardened, you know, chiseled. But, wow.
Yeah.
And that was just amazing.
Yeah, I have that is one of these amazing stories, which, again, doesn't get picked up in a census of religious denominations where you're looking for the typical white church has a steeple on it and things. This is you drive by the Jesus Auto Body Shop, could be Jesus Body Shop, you never know, but until you actually look in, which is really cool what you're doing, looking into all the alleyways and the crevices of the city to find this flourishing of religion in places you would never expect.
Yeah, you know, one of my reporters, Melissa Kimiotti, who's our deputy director and assistant editor, recalled one moment that scared her the most and was also the most surprising and in some ways ended up funny. We were out on the street in Brooklyn in an area called Crown Heights. In fact, in an area called Weeksville. Now, Weeksville is the first African-American community in Brooklyn. It's a historic community. And we were standing on the street, and we had Christopher Smith, who was one of our reporters, was at one church, and Melissa Kimiotti is at another church, and we were just about to finish. And I said, some guy was sitting, leaning back in his wonderful old vintage car. This is a pretty poor area, but he had this wonderful vintage car, and he was leaning back, and he said, what are you guys doing? I said, well, I told him we're looking at religious sites. And he said, oh, man, there's more churches you can count and shake a stick at in this area. And I said, yeah, that's what we're trying to do. He says, well, I think you missed one. I said, what do you mean? He said, you see that doorway over there where the drug dealers are at? He says, behind that doorway is a church. And so I go, and I send Christopher there, and he comes back and says, there is a church, and they're doing an exorcism. And he says, I'm not very comfortable with that. And I said, okay, you and Melissa go in there and watch what's going on. And for Melissa, who is one of the, you might say at this time, sort of one of the nuns that people talk about, religious nuns, goes in there, and she was, it was very, she couldn't help but think about the exorcist and Linda Blair, and she kept saying to herself, oh, God, I hope the demon doesn't jump into me. But she stayed. We teach them that you stay there, and the Reverend McKnight, who was there, really was very welcoming, and so Melissa asked, well, can I film the exorcism? I mean, we just showed up, right?
Right.
And they said, yeah, sure, you can film it. And so Christopher and Smith and Melissa Kimiotti filmed this and ended up with a really great, unusual story. And also this church, this woman who was very disturbed, ends up, whatever one thinks about exorcism and all, this woman who was basically homeless, ends up more stable, goes back home to join her mother, and is going to a Seventh-day Adventist church in Harlem today. So that was a funny, scared, surprising, awkward moment that we just run across all the time. And it goes to the point, there's a pattern of changes going on in the city that if you look at them individually, it's just a moment. But if you start looking and see that they daisy chain together all over the city in many daisy chains, then you start to see, oh, there's a lot of patterns here going on that that's changing the very nature of what New York City is, and really, perhaps it shows the changing nature of the world.
And your website does a fantastic job of doing that. As I mentioned before, it's an extravaganza of all these different multimedia things. You got music, you got video, you have just straight up reporting with the written word, and you also have recipes, which we'll get to a little bit later. It's a really neat site. And if you do start looking at your website, you do see these individual stories, but then again, start to build some patterns with it. I do want to cover some of the individual stories because our listeners have been demanding it. And there's a couple fascinating ones that you've featured recently that I would like you to talk about. One of those is the Jackie Robinson story. The movie 42 just came out a month or so ago. It received rave reviews. You followed up on that, and being that Jackie Robinson grew up in New York City. So tell us a little bit about what you found there.
Well, he didn't grow up in New York City, but you're right that he actually grew up mainly out in Pasadena, California. But the time he came to New York City, and when he became famous as the first African-American in the major big leagues of baseball, he had lived a life of faith. And actually, it was one of the reasons was chosen by the owner, Ricky, to do. And it's an incredible story. And really, though the movie does lightly touch on it, most of the news media stories and even longer narratives often leave us wondering what's the nature of Jackie Robinson's faith. He was a member of a gang when he grew up in Los Angeles, and it was a minor gang. It wasn't a really big gang. It was more like a bunch of kids together causing trouble. It was called the Pepper Street Gang, which was the street he and his family lived on. And the mother was a deeply powerful Christian faith, and she knew that the Lord would answer her prayers for Jackie Robinson, and she also approached a pastor there and said, you know, Pastor, I need you to reach out to my son. And Pastor Downs was at the Scott United Methodist Church, and he went down to the street corner where the Pepper Street Gang hung out and started talking to people. And he asked if Jackie Robinson was there, and none of the gang would point to Robinson, who was standing there. So he gave his patter and says, you know, I need some, you ought to come over to the Methodist Church because we're trying to create a community center for kids so they can do things, you know, sports and things like that. And eventually, Jackie Robinson identified himself, and they started talking, and Jackie and his gang members started going to that church. And Jackie Robinson comes, you know, he has a conversion experience, and he becomes a Sunday school teacher in the church.
Wow, yeah.
And then when he moved and went to the Army, it happened that Reverend Downs went to, Jackie Robinson was in the Army down in Texas, and Reverend Downs happened to be moved to a college, a black college in Texas, so they got together every weekend. So when Branch Rickey, who was the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers and the operating owner, was going to hire an African-American, and he himself was a Methodist lay activist, he searched the leagues for the right player, somebody that would have the character not to strike back. You know, Jesus said, you know, turn the other cheek. He wanted somebody that could turn the other cheek because he knew it was going to be like hell for the first African-American. There's a lot of racism. And so he met secretly with Jackie Robinson, and they talked about that, and he asked if Jackie Robinson could turn the other cheek, and Jackie Robinson, I said, you know, I can, and I have two cheeks, and folks can be struck. And so Jackie Robinson went and told the press as well, he's a Methodist, I'm a Methodist, God's a Methodist, we can't go wrong with Jackie Robinson. Well, you know, so Jackie Robinson comes. Now, the story doesn't end there. Jackie Robinson comes to New York, and he wants to make sure that he has the resources to withstand all the attacks. And he meets another pastor who offers him and his wife a place to stay, a Reverend Covington, Lacey Covington, and also helps Jackie Robinson find their own place. And what's interesting is before every ball game in Brooklyn that Jackie Robinson played, he and his wife and family would go to church at the Covington's church and then have dinner afterwards at the pastor. The pastor had a big house and lots of members and other people would come in and out, and Robinsons were always there. So Jackie Robinson, the civil rights action, was based in his faith, in his Christian faith. And this is, as we know, gave him the power, the strength, and the vision, and a sense of dignity that he held himself and was admired for. Then, when he retired from baseball, he made a habit of helping the church to gather food and materials to help the homeless and the poor in the church. And every week, he would pick up, he'd go around to food warehouses, distribution points, and say, you know, what food that you have left over that you know is getting old, that can I, and he would pack up his trunk, and then he would go by the church and drop it off, the church in Brooklyn. Well, one day he was not feeling well, he just felt down, but he said, I've got to make sure I get the food to the church so that we can provide for the homeless and the poor. And so he packs up, he goes around, he collects everything, he packs it up, he drops it off at Reverend Covington's old church, and he goes home, he says he's not feeling well, he goes to bed, and that early morning hours he passed away of a heart attack. In other words, from the beginning to the end, he led a life of faith, and he sacrificed his life in a sacrificial way, following Jesus' example. It's a powerful testimony to the role that faith has had in changing this nation and in this city. And Jackie Robinson is, we went and traced down all the places that Jackie Robinson had been. We traced down photos of him from his early Pepper Street days, his white mother, his the past, the church, the pictures of the pastors, the pictures of Jackie Robinson going into the pastor's house and going out of the house, and the picture of Jackie Robinson in the pulpit preaching. Mm-hmm. And I, far as I know, that no other a new story did any coverage like that, and it's a story that the role of faith, and then people of faith, whether they're Christian or something else, or even they're non-faith, they can say, you know what, I can see how that had an important role, and you know, we've got to take that into account when we talk about we're going to change this society, this nation, or this city for the good. And so I always go back to that October day, October 23rd, 1972, that Jackie Robinson busied himself gathering food for the pantry at the church, that his last sacrificial act was to lay down his life for the poor.
Yeah, quite an amazing story, and you guys do such a tremendous job of filling that in. I know the movie 42 really focuses on a very narrow moment in his life, and we don't pick up a lot of this story. So, you know, again, what your website does is fill in a lot of the details and crevices and of people's lives that we oftentimes overlook. I do want to ask you about another sports story, and this is one that's a little bit more contemporary, given that we just talked about Jackie Robinson, and I'm a somewhat of a baseball fan, but I'm a bigger football fan. And recently, you've been going through this brouhaha with Tim Tebow out there at the New York Jets. You have a short paragraph or two on your website about it, but given that you're in New York City and you're always focused on religion and thinking about how it's affecting the city, give us some idea of how this, I don't want to say it's a controversy, or how this phenomenon of Tim Tebow being called to New York and then not playing and then being let go and not being basically homeless in the sports sense of the terms. How does that all play out from your vantage point?
Well, yes, and our New York professional sports teams have really let down the people of faith with Tim Tebow and Jeremy Lin with the Knicks. And I assume they had their, you know, various reasons. Tim Tebow excited a lot, created a lot of excitement in the city. And it's because he's a representative of something that's important in this city. This city is filled with migrants, or young migrants, from around the United States and from around the world. There are young people coming here wanting to make their mark. Probably between 300,000 and 500,000 new people come to New York every year. And now a large number move out, too. And a large portion of those are young people. And so Tim Tebow, excited, and Jeremy Lin, create a lot of excitement because there are a lot of young people here in the city, and this is somebody they could identify with. And there are a lot of young people who are very religious. And so they were very excited. In fact, Jeremy Lin, just shift slightly, I'll go back to Tebow. Jeremy Lin, the player with the New York Knicks, that his exciting play was called Linsanity. You know, one of his Bible study mate in at Harvard was now works for the New York Times. So a young, very crackerjack reporter, and named Michael Luo. So there was all of this. Tebow excited the imagination of a lot of the younger people in New York City. And so many media sources came to us. We decided that we would not cover it and not cover it in time. We don't cover daily news usually.
Right.
So we have to pick and choose. And we decided on this one that it would absorb maybe too much time for us to cover. But so what we would do is we would give up our information to other media people. And so we, AP and Time Magazine and New York Magazine and, you know, all these people came to us and said, well, where would Tim Tebow go to church? They somehow became fascinated with that idea. And so we gave them sort of a funny, interesting countdown of where Tim Tebow might go to church. Knowing, of course, that most likely the church he would go to while he was in New York is the chapel that they hold every Sunday at the New York Jets locker room. And there is a long history of faith activity and belief among New York Jets. One of the most remarkable ones is Michael Faulkner, who's a pastor here in the city now in Harlem, also a head of a faith-based enterprise to improve the health of poor communities all over New York State, actually. Mike Faulkner came. He came on more or less herald. He was a lineman, so, you know, linemen don't get quite the fame of Tim Tebow. But he came, and he was a really good lineman. He came from a really rough high school in Washington, D.C., but he, you know, faith preserved him and changed his life, and then he got here, and he blew out a knee. But rather than, you know, just say, well, my life is over because I can't play football anymore, Reverend Faulkner threw himself into pastoring. He started a church. It became a very, he worked at several churches, and he went to a church that became very popular for young African-American professionals, Buppies. And then he decided, well, you know, I've been really successful at this, but, you know, who I really have my heart for is to reach out to the poor. So he left a very successful pastorate and to start a church in Harlem, in a poor area of Harlem, New Horizons Church. And he's making an impact there, and he has now added this new faith base to improve the eating, the health, to create new cooking habits and recipes for poor communities all across the city and the state. So this, so we didn't hold on to Tim Tebow. His faith was his basic pastor was his father, Tim handled it very well. He was under and also his other quarterback, Sanchez. They were put into competition, but he was never used, and they never really gave him hardly any time. And the Jets organization claimed they were going to create plays for him, and they created very few plays and very little practice at them. So he didn't really get much of a tryout here. I can only imagine that he was used by the Jets are divided in their you know, in their management, and I don't think that the result is the general manager of the Jets left. The Tim Tebow decision has created a big shakeup at the Jets, and the new general manager, you know, doesn't want the old decisions to govern him because that wasn't his decision. So he decided to get rid of Tim Tebow, and so we have a new, you know, he's now become orphaned in
yep.
a way that he couldn't really be picked up very well by anybody else. But he, basically, his church here while he was in New York was the chapel at the Jets locker room. And he was very private, and knowing that the media was all over the place on him, he handled himself amazingly well. The pressure on him and people looking for him to slip up in any possible way was intense. We've got, you know, 25,000-30,000 journalists in this city. I mean, it's like no other city. And so the scrum was really large. And you know, we would like to cover those type of stories more often. But that's one way in the future we're looking to hire somebody that will do daily reporting for us. Because we have ability to reach right in. In Jeremy Lin's case, his family, some of his relatives live actually not very far away from where I live. So I could just walk over there and do the interviews with the family, but we decided not to do that.
Well, one of the cool things that you do in your website is you don't chase the hottest stories of the time. You really focus on things that people aren't seeing. And one of the more interesting aspects that you've covered is the business scene in New York City. I mean, we think of New York City as being a thriving business area, and you think of Wall Street, and when that comes up, you think of corporate greed, and you just think of, you know, not a big moral foundation behind New York City business, very cutthroat and such. One of the things that you do is you highlight what is going on with business on a big scale, but also on a small scale. And a few weeks ago, you highlighted a story about a hat maker, or I guess a hat salesperson or a hat sales shop in Harlem. I think it was called the Harlem's Heaven, and blending this, you know, their faith with their business. And you also had another story recently too about something called Divine Connection Hair Spa, which are, again, I think it's another place that's in Harlem where people are taking their faith and they're putting it into practice in their daily business life, just like Jesus's Auto Body Shop. Tell us a little bit about those stories, because the video you did for the hat shop was really fun and really inspiring.
Well, it is a lot of fun, and sometimes we don't know that they're really faith-based businesses until we go in. One thing we're finding is that and this is actually these type of stories lead to an important finding. Leads actually don't create the change; the social change and don't create the religious change. Not the elites and the centers of power that create change. They usually want to stay the way they are. It's the outsider. It's the people on the outside who have new ideas. And then, of course, they want to move to the inside, and some elites join with them to change things. Of course, the paradigm is Jesus. He was not an elite. He moved in toward where the center of power is. A few people, like Joseph of Arimathea and Saul, broke away from the elites to join him. But, of course, Jesus got killed by the elites. What we've discovered is that you find all over the city people creating really new, interesting things in small ways. Some of them will end up entering into the center of action and become elite. One of these was Harlem's Heaven. Now, I must say I did not know about the shop, but we were in Harlem, and I was on foot at this point because there was so, we usually travel by car, but there's so many faith-based sites in the city, I parked and we all walked. And there was a place called, a hat shop called Harlem's Heaven. And I thought to myself, I said, you know, maybe that's just like, you know, like heavenly, you know, sort of metaphorical use. But I said, I better go check it out. So I go in, and it turns out that Yvetta, who runs the shop, it's a faith-based shop. She's a hat designer, a really good one, elaborate hats. Easter hats, other types of hats, church hats. And she's active in her church, and so she, and then I discover, as I talk to her some more, and I discover she has a person that acts sort of like a chaplain. And back in the back, in their workroom, they use it for a chapel. Mm-hmm. That is to take people in the council, because often people come with the hats, they won't buy a new hat because their marriage is broken up, so they won't feel good about themselves. Or they're just feeling down, and they say, well, you don't only need a new hat, you need a new life. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, that's incredible. Divine Connections is a funny story. Again, we were driving by, and it was a hair salon. And this one is not in Harlem. It's actually in the Crown Heights, Flatbush area of Brooklyn. I said, well, we better check it out. It's got the word divine, so maybe it indicates something. So Melissa Camiani goes in, and the owner's not there, but... And the person's, you know, a little bit hesitant. What are you doing? You know, what do you want? And she tells her and explains. And so the woman calls the owner, Nicole Walters, and says, "What's going on?" And Melissa explains to the owner that, well, you know, that what they're doing. She said, "Oh." Well, that's why I call it Divine Connection, because in my life, I was not doing well in life, and I had a spiritual revival, and I decided that I would form my own hair salon, and I would say the reason we have that hair salon is because I made a divine connection. And she has created, design-wise, what she thinks reflects her Christian faith. It's a place of more healing than of gossip, a place of beauty that parallels the idea of glory, and so forth. By the way, both Yvetta and Nicole, Yvetta at the Harlem's Heaven and Nicole had become really famous in their field. Yvetta from Harlem's Heaven called me and emailed me and said, by the way, you know, I'm designing now hats for the Manalo Blahnik collection. Manalo Blahnik evidently is a very high price shoe that people wear. Very famous, high price, you know, particularly stiletto type shoes. And she says, you know, they're doing an ad campaign and they're going to feature my hats. And a couple of museums have picked up her hats. And then I found out about Nicole Walters. I knew nothing about hair salons. And it turns out she's a a championship winner in all these big contests about doing hair design. And evidently they have these really, really big, like Clairol has awards for the best hair design, best stylist in coloring hair and all this types of stuff. And she won the Clairol Professional Award as the best stylist in the United States.
Hmm.
And she quoted a proverb when she accepted
wow.
the award. She said, "A wise man has great power, and a man of knowledge increases strength." Proverbs 24:5. And I'm thinking, wow, we could, I mean, we would have never known, except that Melissa went in there, created a connection to the help that so that they would call the owner, and then we told us this great story. Now, the point being is, one of the important sort of theoretical points, or you might say sociological points, is that these changes are not coming from the center of power. They're coming from the working class, the outsider, the migrant, the immigrant. They come into the center of power, and they want to make it. They create new ideas, because that's one way you make it, is to create something new. They want to change things because they're being kept out, so they want to make place for themselves. And, in fact, the theorist of this idea of social change is Robert Nisbet, who was a professor at Columbia University for many years, and wrote a little book called Social Change and History. It's a wonderful book about how does social change happen? Does it happen in sort of a step-by-step social evolution so that, you know, and that it goes step-by-step, slow, you know, inevitable, with elites guiding the process? No. Usually change comes from intruders from the outside who shake things up. And part of the insiders break away to join the intruders, and they create a new thing. One of our most influential churches, Redeemer Presbyterian Church, that's pastored by and founded by Tim Keller, he's not from New York. He was an outsider. He was even an outsider to the positive faith, coming from a sort of Italian, half-Italian background in Philadelphia. And so he comes to New York. He's an outsider. He decides to go right into the center of power, Manhattan, and said, we're going to, you know, make a difference. And he innovated a new way of doing church for the city. He took a lot of other ideas and strung them together so they were user-friendly to New York and other cities, and so it's having a big impact. Faith-based businesses are often started by sort of the working class or people on the way up. Our seminaries are not equipped. Our rabbinical schools are not equipped to handle that.
Yeah.
Most leadership programs and seminary programs on faith and work, almost all of them are geared toward elites, the professionals. And, you know, if you look at whether it's at Fuller or Westminster, and I don't mean to pick on them, or Dallas Seminary or wherever, as far as I know, there's not one course on working class faith, on faith and work among the working class in all the United States. In fact, there is one course, but it's not a seminary. It's the AFL-CIO has a chaplain, and he has an institute that trains people how to connect their faith to the work. But by and large, people have bought in this idea that change happens with the elites first, and therefore all the faith work programs are more geared toward elites. Become a leader, you know. Become, you know, the cutting edge, you know. Go for the top. In fact, an awful lot of the change that we see going on in this city are coming from outsiders who are working their way up from the bottom. And then they attract certain elites who say, oh, this is a new idea. If we get on the escalator now, we're going to go even higher up. That's what happens here in the city. In the faith-based side, the faith-based businesses, we call them the FBBs, the faith-based businesses, are a pretty important stream of activity in the city that is not captured any place. And we run across it very, very often, and we actually don't have any estimate about that because we see a sign, we see a Muslim saying, or we see a Quran in the window or something, we'll go in. But very often, you know, it's just not, you know, you can't tell from the outside.
Yeah.
And we probably, even though we visited and we featured quite a few faith-based businesses, we know that we probably missed, you know, almost most of them. And there are also, of course, we don't count the kosher and halal. These is
the delicatessens and such.
Places operate according to Jewish or Muslim law because there's so many of them.
Right.
So there are that. But, you know, I'll give you another example that was surprising about the faith-based business. I found out that at the across from the old World Trade Center site, I ran across at really early in the morning a bunch of black limos pulled up. And they were Korean limousine drivers. And they had, at 4 in the morning, while they're waiting to go pick up, you know, the high powers down in Wall Street area, they park all around the circle, which the police won't take in, so they can park in this, there's a little circular area down there. And they have their Bible study. We had never, ever picked that up that we were traveling around. And we do travel around at different times of the day just to gauge it, but we don't obviously do this very often. And we just picked up this, and it turned out that this limousine is very faith-based, and this limousine service, and there were several of them represented, but the one guy that we interviewed that led the Bible study, as part of a service that is faith-based in its basis, and this is a Korean, but they go and wash their cars, get this, at a car wash in which there's a pizza shop called Blessed Pizza. It's right near LaGuardia Airport. And so I went out back to that Blessed Pizza to find out what was going on to the car wash shop. Actually, I totally independent of this other. I knew they washed their cars there, but I didn't know. And I went to the shop. And I noticed there's this Blessed Pizza. So I go in, and it's in the back. I mean, literally, it's off the beaten track. But it's near LaGuardia Airport, so they can pop in and wash the car and then go and pick up people. And I asked the pizza dealer, I said, you know, why do you call this Blessed Pizza? And he said, well, because when people come here, I give them pizza, and I give them a prayer in their soul as they walk out. Wow! That is a type of innovation going on in a very small level that affects the city. And so we want to try to tell that story in a fun and exciting, and it's a lot, it's across the board. It's not only Christian, it's not only Jewish, it's not only Muslim. I mean, it's across the board you find across these innovations. Of course, most people work in, you know, in a larger organization, and a big problem in the city related to this is that our understandings of gentrification are inadequate to what goes on in today's cities. Most gentrification says, well, it focuses on ousting the poor and housing and stuff like that. In fact, almost all the literature is focused on, you know, either jobs or housing or income disparities. And that's part of it. But what is missed is the religious dimension of gentrification. What's happening in this city is as you gentrify, it becomes more and more expensive for community groups to find space so they can meet. And this includes religious groups. Mm-hmm. So a really important aspect of gentrification, which can be good for a city, renews itself through things like gentrification, but what needs to be taken into account is not only the housing issue. In fact, most of the poor here in New York have assurance of their housing if they're living in it during gentrification. But what they don't have assurance of, and what's really hurting the poor and working classes of this city, is that as areas like Harlem gentrify, the poorer people that are in housing are guaranteed the housing. They don't, they're not, if they move, they have a problem. But if they're in a housing project or they're in a rent-subsidized apartment, they will be able to maintain that. But what they do lose, they lose the community groups that were used to be meeting in basements, like stickball clubs.
Mm-hmm.
They've disappeared from Harlem. Stickball clubs used to be a fact of life in East Harlem, particularly. And there would be stickball clubs all around up in East Harlem and parts of Harlem. And people would meet there and, you know, they'd play stickball in the street. And, you know, Geraldo Rivera and his friend Diaz kept out of the gang life by going to, if I understand it right, by belonging to a stickball club. But, and so they kept out of the streets, out of the gang life. Well, Geraldo Rivera being the, you know, the famous television broadcaster, and Ruben Diaz being a locally famous reporter, TV reporter here. Well, what happens? That's disappearing, and that is impacting the faith centers even more. Part of the controversy that arose over church and public school was a controversy over the and this is not understood, that it was caused by the gentrification of the city. Church groups particularly, and other faith groups, Jewish and Muslim and Hindu, don't have places to meet, because before they could rent a basement or an empty storefront, but now those storefronts are triple or quadruple in price, basements are no longer available. They didn't have any place to meet. So the people in the housing project, like in East Harlem, they didn't have a church to go to because of gentrification. So the project director there allowed a church to meet in the housing project community room. Now, there's not very much space in most housing projects, so there's only the community rooms. But at least they had that. Well, then the city decided to kick them out because the mayor doesn't like these religious groups, and the lawyers for the city are sort of anti-religious. And they decided to kick them out of the housing projects and the schools, the public schools where they're meeting. And there were lots of different types. Mainly there were evangelical, Pentecostal, Protestant groups, but there were also Jewish groups and Muslim groups and other types of religious groups using these public spaces to meet in. And the reason they were meeting is that with gentrification had no place could poor people have their community organizations meet, including their churches and their synagogues. And so they went into these public spaces. In Harlem, there are lots of housing projects, and the poor people basically have lost the community meeting spaces as it gentrifies, and the only space they have are these housing projects and public school. So the city, because urban planning does not include, by and large, a religion dimension in its plan, they forgot that with the shrinkage of community spaces affecting the religious aspects of the city. And then when they went to kick out in the name of sort of some sort of rational order and secular rational order to kick out the religious groups from meeting in these places, they're basically telling the poor people of the city, we don't care about your community life. All we care about is that, well, you have housing, you have, which is important, but as far as your community life goes, too bad, it's gone. Now, this also affects, of course, the gentrifiers, because a lot of the gentrifiers are not really, really rich. They are sort of well-off professionals. And when they want to hold a Quran reading, or they want to hold a rabbinical study, or they want to hold a Bible study, but they're finding out in Manhattan and in other areas of gentrification, it's almost impossible to find space. You can no longer walk from your workplace to do a Quran study because there's just no space. Nobody will rent you anything that's reasonable. And so now what's happening is coming to bite the gentrifiers.
Mm-hmm.
That the gentrifiers, too, are desperate for space. And, in fact, there's so many organizations I know of, faith-based organizations, that are constantly on the lookout for space. Can we be... Churches now have three or four, some places, you know, they may have six churches meeting in one church space. And during the week, they have, you know, maybe in one place, I'd say there was probably 100 groups using the place during the week, from Alcoholics Anonymous to, you know, a community board meeting were using a church space. And they're doubling up, they're tripling up, they're quadrupling up. They're, you know, I don't know what 100 is.
Multiplying massively.
And so that is a huge issue all around the country.
Yeah.
It's a huge issue here. Well, the faith-based businesses do provide some space for people, but it's not enough.
Long sermon, sorry. Yeah. Well, this is one of the things that I really like about your website and your project, A Journey Through New York City Religions, because you cover a lot of these things that we don't normally see, especially as sociologists and academics of religion who are always looking for the religious folks in the churches on the Sunday morning or on Saturday or on Friday, whatever the particular day of worship your faith tradition might be. But, you know, places like Blessed Pizza and Harlem's Heaven and Divine Connection are places where religious life is really taking place in New York. Really, really brings this to the fore. It's such a vibrant religious community, and you're doing a wonderful job in doing this. I have a whole list of other things that we haven't been able to cover today, but we are definitely running short of time here. So you've basically earned yourself another interview in the future, because I want to keep following this project. And I just want to leave off with one final question. How far are you along in this project, and what's up next for you guys? Are you just kind of stumbling around and finding Blessed Pizza places, or do you have a plan?
We've gone through about 70% of the community districts of New York, and we hope to finish them up this year. So we would have covered every street, every alleyway, every hallway and shopping centers in New York City by the end of the year. However, we plan, we can see that the city's constantly changing, and we're going to go back to places that we know are changing fast and places that we know are great stories that we weren't able to cover. So that's first. Second, we want to do a faster production and editing so that we can, we produce about the same number of stories and features on religion as the New York Times, but we won't actually do it at a faster rate and be basically the media source for religion in the city. We also are starting journey workshops. These are workshops teaching people around the country, around the world, how we do our type of journalism, which is we've developed a certain style of journalism that's different from what's taught in journalism school. We've partnered one such workshop with Columbia University School of Journalism, and also with other schools of journalism. We work with Bethel University in Minnesota to try a journey out in St. Paul, Minneapolis, Minnesota. We hope that we've been talking to a Chinese journalist about doing this type of thing, and in fact, we happen to know that they are beginning to do this. They got a website. They're trying to do this in China. We sent out our deputy director out to Asia this last couple of months to scout out possibilities to start a journey through, you know, Hong Kong religion, a journey through Jakarta religion, a journey through Shanghai religion, so we want to. And we are doing a day workshops for different schools, ranging from high school through graduate school here in the city. And we will make that reproducible. And we also think that our idea that the city is not the secular city, it's not the religious city. The cities of the world today are post-secular, in which the religious and secular have an equal space, an equal voice, an equal jockeying together. We think that's actually a model for many religious groups to use in order to reach out to younger people, because we find most of our volunteers are young and they are religious nuns. Yet they find this intriguing and interesting, and they can explore faith on their own terms. It's not sort of pushed on them. They do it on their own terms. They do their own exploration. And they do it in a way that, you know, is disciplined, because we're a journalist organization. I ran across a place like this in Austin, Texas, called Vox Veni. This was a Chinese-American church, started a church in East Austin, which is a black and Hispanic area of Austin. And they created first as a community space in which the church would meet there as like another tenant. And they invited the community around to come and use that community space and come to be sort of a post-secular space for Austin, Texas, African-American, Mexican, gentrifying area. We believe this is sort of the wave of the future, and we're beginning to see it pop up in other cities, and we want to figure out how to support that and reproduce that.
Well, Tony, you definitely have your pulse upon this growing trend, and I'm going to have you back again on the show to talk more and more about this, because New York is a big place, and as you expand globally to Austin, Texas, and to Jakarta, we're going to have a lot of things to discuss and follow. But as for right now, I want to thank you for being once again on Research on Religion.
Thank you, West Coast Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.